Hi there, Paul. So this is Dan Rycroft from UEA.
Hi, Dan.
Hi there. We've got together to discuss this article on the future archaeology of Israel's colonisation, and we're looking forward to participating in a somewhat disembodied way at the Future Memory Symposium. So can I just start first by asking you a bit about your own intellectual position and how you've come to have an interaction with this project?
Yeah, sure. Well, I am working in the English Literature Department at the University of Exeter. I'm a member of the Centre for Victorian Studies there. And I have worked with Lena before on her migrations project. I completed a book which was entitled Globalisation and the Great Exhibition, The Victorian New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out at the start of this year. And one of the principal aims of that project was to explore how the world's first international industrial display was understood by Victorian commentators to sanction Britain's imperial mandate,
right,
if you like. I mean, put bluntly, as it often was, what the Great Exhibition allowed Victorian commentators to do was to identify certain normally non-European peoples who had failed in these Victorian commentators' eyes to mix properly their labour with their land.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed Britain to suggest that these peoples should be reintegrated into a Victorian world order according to the economic needs of the Victorian metropolis.
Do you think this idea of land was addressed in a complicated way at the time, or do you think it was
I'm interested in, or what my work is trying to do is suggest that actually there's a kind of imperial fantasy that lies at the heart of the Great Exhibition, which is a reductive fantasy, which simply
mm-hmm.
says, given that these peoples are supposedly backward, they can be positioned quite simply as producers of primary goods to supply British industry and consumers of British-made manufactured products.
Mm-hmm.
So in the kind of terms that I use, it's which is borrowed from Marxist geographers, this is an imperial vision of de- and re-territorialisation.
Right.
I think in the terms of today's workshop, we might understand it as a vision of de- and replacement.
Okay. So that gives us something maybe to pick up on a little bit later.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, I'm interested in the work you've been doing, because I've been working for the last few years on colonialism and imperialism as related to the 19th and 20th centuries in India.
Okay.
And so some of what you've been working on has been, I've been able to use it in relation to my understanding of some national and also subnational resistance movements, the national level being the Swadeshi movement, which was to do with the national boycotting of the primary goods that you were just mentioning.
Okay.
And then I also had the opportunity to work critically in relation to the Great Exhibition, like you, because I have been looking at the formation of visual cultures of imperialism and how certain editorial and visual production strategies enabled the imperial regime to be embodied in very careful and critical ways in the middle of the 19th century.
Okay.
And I've also been thinking about the impact that the images made at that time have had in some of these so-called non-European contexts.
Mm-hmm. And so, just thinking through that kind of reductive imperial fantasy that I outlined, did you detect in your own research a similar relationship that was set up by your own Victorian sources with relation to India and its proper position or place within an imperial order?
Yeah, the idea of land and mineral resources is at the heart of a lot of the colonisation that went on in central India, which is the area that I have been researching. And I conducted my research through a critical biography of one of the members of the East Indian Company called Walter Sherwill, who was an economic geologist and
okay.
also a fairly competent artist, and he contributed work, his own visual work at the Great Exhibition, and he also disseminated a lot of his images through the Illustrated London News. So part of how I approach that visual culture is to think about the network of images and ideas between the colonialist context and the imperial metropole, the centre.
Sure, because I think that then one of the things that we've both been looking at, and one of the things that the essay raises, is this fantasy when people are thinking through place and what they might do with place, this fantasy of a tabula rasa, of an ability to begin afresh. And I think that, I mean, it's no accident then that you, that your own work led you to focus on mineral resources, for instance,
mm-hmm.
just as some of my own work would lead me to focus on the way in which India might be positioned as a primary producer of cotton for Manchester
right.
mills.
Right.
And so this desire to re-territorialise according to a new beginning seems to be particularly powerful.
And there's a very strong emphasis on narrative within all this as well. You know, this idea of beginnings with future trajectories. You know, the imagining of the future through the imperial policies and the colonial dynamics. And in a way, this perhaps feeds into one approach that we might be able to bring to future memory, because I mean, I've been interested in the administrative memory of anti-colonial resistance movements in India. So how certain categories of being were constructed through the suppression of these movements, and so that would then feed into the administrative memory. And more recently I've been thinking about the relationship between administrative memory and some colonial ethnological and ethnographic practices.
So as I understand it, the new aspect of your research is thinking through ways in which, or strategies that were deployed in order to kind of problematize that imperial fantasy, or that imperial desire to position territory in a particular kind of way.
Yeah, I've been a lot of my thinking for the book that I wrote called Representing Rebellion was formulated within the intellectual fabric of the Subaltern Studies Collective, and I tried to bring a critical visual historiography to their textual historiographical interventions.
Yeah.
And so I was drawing on, the main kind of so-called historical event that I was drawing on was the Santal Rebellion, which took place in 1855 to 1857, and then was throughout that period suppressed by the East India Company. And that was, of course, just before the onset of the so-called Indian mutinies in 1857, 1858. So there was a real sort of cataclysmic change to social practice in India at that time, and the recolonization of India through the Raj came in as a result of the suppression of the 1857 mutiny rebellions.
Mm-hmm.
But more particularly, the ethnographic side has become relevant to me because I've been thinking about the collective memory of the Santal Rebellion amongst some of the indigenous or Adivasi peoples in India, who are minority indigenous or minority ethnic peoples. And so the Hul, as it's known, H-U-L, also formed one of the analytical strands of Ranjit Guha's historiographic work in terms of his understanding of peasant insurgencies.
Okay.
And that was a very formulaic sort of foundational text for Subaltern Studies.
Okay. Well, I think that's helpful because I think it moves us on then in thinking about the ways in which places can be contested
mm-hmm.
through narrative form or through shared historical imaginaries
mm-hmm.
to discuss the essay. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things that struck me most was that Sandy Hilal, Alessandro Petti and Ayal Weizman discuss this desire for destruction.
Mm-hmm.
They say that seeks to turn time backwards, reverse development into virgin nature,
mm-hmm.
a tabula rasa onto which a new set of beginnings could be articulated.
And there's this very interesting also kind of Fanon-esque invocation, you know, of the liberatory methods as well.
Yes, absolutely. But I think, I guess that what from leading on from what you've been talking about, and what struck me perhaps most about this essay was the way in which it brought to the fore the fact that whether this is whether conceived of as an imperial process of de- and re-territorialisation, or as a process intended to resist such imperialism, this desire for destruction that they highlight, what the essay demonstrates is that this won't succeed in establishing this fantasy of a tabula rasa.
Right. But they also bring in other forms of spatial decolonisation as well. I mean, you're right to focus on the destruction aspect, but they also bring in ideas around strategically subverting and appropriating colonial architecture, and also reoccupying as well, which has its own perhaps more limited relevance in their view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this emphasis that they place upon the fact that they work, this must be very clear, in a what they call a less than ideal world, a world where new beginnings are denied, and where the narratives or cultural memories associated with spatial histories are always contested. This means that, you know, this idea that you could have, as they point out, a single unified architectural solution has to give way then. It has to give way to what they call fragments of possibilities. And I guess that's the politics and aesthetics of this essay as it came through to me. This idea that, you know, grand univocal narratives that are not going to work here, just as monolithic architectural structures, are not going to work. They're not going to be able to impose their meanings. They're not going to be able to generate a shared memory in the way that often groups might desire them to.
Do you think that they maybe take a slightly polarized view? I mean, I think maybe Foucault's concept of heterotopia might be brought in, because that in a way thinks us about how in fact dominant architectures are not necessarily all-encompassing. I mean, I don't have the detailed research knowledge of the context in question here, but I'm just thinking that perhaps offers a way of thinking about spatial and architectural dominance that perhaps is less binary in its formulation than as they set out in this particular text.
Yes, I think. I mean, as I understand it, yeah, the Foucauldian notion of the heterotopia would bring with it that sense of a more fragmented architecture and a less. Well, I guess that one of the problems is that, you know, Foucault's notion of power as being dispersed throughout the social body is very, I guess, intellectually current. I think as well there's a sense that actually the very material nature of the architecture that they're discussing perhaps does bring with it a sense of power as you know, in a less sophisticated Foucauldian notion, you know, as a power that is very much of this imperial force. You know, they talk about these emplacements.
But there's one phrase that they bring in near the end of the piece. They say, to inhabit the land is always to inhabit it in relation either to one's present-day enemies or to an imagined or real ancient civilization. I think that's a very grandiose concept in which to throw out there, because I mean, in fact, is that in fact, you know, a true statement? Because it sees the dominance of Israel in very binary terms, I think, and very 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 highly antagonistic and oppositional terms.
Yeah,
and so. I mean, obviously, that's part of the struggle and part of this decolonization, you know, through resistance. But what it draws us to is the fact that there are perhaps multiple citizenships within Palestine, or multiple subjectivities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm so interested in how the ideas that the artists are coming up with are actually going to be taken up within the context, because there are going to be obviously multiple positions in which the struggle and decolonization can be apprehended. And so to have it in this very sort of antagonistic framework or counter hegemonic framework serves, well, it needs to be understood within the wider context of hegemony within Palestine and this idea of, you know, nation and nationalism and nation state within Palestine. And I don't really get a sense of, through reading this, that some of the tensions about some of these multiple subjectivities within Palestine have actually been addressed. It's almost as if we as a reader are being brought into the counter-hegemonic frame.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine from a, you know, a political, in terms of political intervention, but in terms of understanding the issues at stake, it perhaps is a slightly abstract.
Okay, so is perhaps then what you're suggesting there is that there is within the territories under discussion, there is a sort of, there is an imperial Israeli architecture which, you know, which is characterized in terms, for instance, of walls, in terms of fortified emplacements, in terms of, you know, that very overtly aggressive antagonistic architecture. But perhaps you're saying that the essay gestures towards fragments of possibilities and gestures towards a more heterogeneous conceptualization of architecture, but actually you're suggesting that perhaps it doesn't succeed as it might do in working that through.
Well, we have obviously only this article, this very short illustrated article, to go on, and one thing that I've been very interested by is coming to the end of the article to see about the collaborative approach taken by the artist to this much greater project, and I haven't had the opportunity to actually engage with it at that level, so I'm really only giving a very partial account of my understanding of the project as mediated through this article.
Yeah.
But it seems that, you know, there are manuals being made, models, landscape designs being made, stereoscopic video installations being made, other videos being made, which all together would combine to perhaps sort of flesh out some of the ideas that are being raised through the text in a more open-ended way than we would otherwise might encounter through the text itself.
Yes, I think that's right. And it brings me to something actually that when we spoke briefly before we started recording our discussion, something that you pointed out to me, which I thought was right on in terms of that open-ended process, is that you spoke at the end of the essay, they talk about the ways in which a particular site,
the hill
site, has what they call a set of competing graffiti written by one side and then obliterated by the other.
And you were thinking about this metaphor of the palimpsest?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
They say that this testifies to the revolving door occupancy of the site in question. And yes, I mean, I guess inevitably being a literary scholar, I was drawn towards this idea of the palimpsest. That is, the text that has that someone has attempted to efface from view what has written before in order to begin afresh, but actually, you know, what you have is a set of overlaid texts, and that image does bring to the fore this idea of an open-ended struggle, or of at least of an open-ended process. It might not necessarily need to be a struggle, but a sense of a sense that this is open-ended, that it is contested, that there isn't one single meaning that can be associated there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that image of the graffiti was a really, as you said earlier, was a really strong one. Was it in a sense, whilst it was obviously an antagonistic relationship there, it also there are possibilities there and potentialities there associated with that.
And I think, you know, this concept of future memory, the future archaeology, the whole futurity or the visual futures that are generated through the project are very, very exciting. And this is why I'm very interested to know, and I'm sure other people are very interested to know, how it's going to be taken up as a more social, political, spatial intervention rather than one that's located within the domain of the arts.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, one of the things that, as well as this palimpsest image that came to mind, one of the things that I was reminded of is is the Victorian poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who writing in this sort of poem novel Aurora Leigh, she talks about the need for the poet to exert what she calls a double vision.
Mm-hmm.
And by that she means that the poet must look to the past in order to, because always poetry is going to be placed with what's gone before.
Mm-hmm.
But that you can't be dominated by what's gone before. You have to exert this double vision in order that you can reimagine a new future as well, one that situates yourself in relation to the past, but also can see oneself moving away from that past.
There's this very interesting use of the term apprehension by somebody who's commentated on some of this work. I'm sure the artists are familiar because it's all through their website. Sari Hanafi,
yep.
I've just seen the outline of one of her lectures, and she's talking about the apprehension of space leading towards a rethinking of this highly territorialized concept of nationhood. And I think it's in conversation with Irit Rogov, and she's bringing in perhaps the need to think not necessarily about deterritorializing or deplacing, but re-territorializing through the kinds of spatial historical imaginings that the artists and writers here deal with. So there's definitely a very engaging body of material here.
Yeah, absolutely. That when I was reading that piece by Hanafi, I was struck by the way in which, well, it's actually Irit Rogov who talks about this prefix re,
mm-hmm.
in all these projects: return, recolonization, and reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
He says if one is thinking in terms of a critical epistemology, the re is the recognition that one is starting from the middle rather than from the beginning.
Mm.
And I think that spoke to this project very much. It also reminded me of the geographer Doreen Massey has written recently in this kind of manifesto that she writes called For Space, and she really does, she demands that we recognise space as the, well, she says that as the sphere in which distinct trajectories coexist, as the sphere of coexisting heterogeneity.
Mm.
And then she said, perhaps we could imagine space as a simultaneity of stories so far.
Mm-hmm.
And that comment, a simultaneity of stories so far, spoke to this particular architectural project, I felt, but also perhaps to this, to the project, to the Future Memories project,
yeah.
more generally.
Yeah.
That simultaneity of different narratives that are occurring at the same time in the same place seems to be a particularly important strand of the project.
Okay, can I just ask you one final question, which would be to do with this idea of collectivity and cultural identity, whether as artists, the group working on this project should perhaps be situating it more within a more widely socialized or even socialist praxis within Palestinian Israeli areas.
I think that one of the things, and I guess it's maybe it's perhaps it's inevitable when you're dealing with this with these kind of stark conflicts, you know, the Palestine-Israel conflict, is that one of the things that happens is that you perhaps do, despite yourself, end up thinking in terms of, at times, monolithic conceptions of the bodies that you're thinking through. And yes, there was an element to the essay where I felt the emphasis upon a collective communal use of space that was being proposed as against the kind of bourgeois capitalist individualist use of the territory under the Israelis, which as the authors quite rightly pointed out, you know, if things left to their own devices, you know, that would be taken up by the new Palestinian state as well. So there is this I did tend to see it in terms of a kind of socialist utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's one to to which, you know, I've no necessary problems with at all. But obviously one of the things that that can do is cause a sort of monolithic conception of the peoples who are inhabiting this place. I mean, one of the things that did strike me was the ways in which the writers were thinking through the ways in which space might be used in this in these new architectural forms. It did strike me that the kind of rhetoric that they were associating with that is one that I might associate with the way in which you know, certain socialist Zionist visions of space were being thought through, you know, post 1948.
Okay.
I guess the idea of the kibbutz is particularly to the fore there, and mm-hmm. I think a more overt discussion of the ways in which those two conceptualizations of space might be fruitful, I think.
So there's definitely space within the project, and perhaps also within this text, for an increased attention to multivocality, this idea of multiple meanings and multiple voices emerging?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think so.
Okay, Paul, should we leave it there? Because we're now on 25 minutes, and I'm sure the listeners in the conference probably want to stretch their legs.
Okay, then. Thanks very much, Dan.
Bye then, Paul.
Bye.